This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. We're here. It's the peak of hurricane season, and fortunately it's been a quiet summer. So far we've been spared from the tropical weather that causes wind damage, flooding, and even storm surge. Beyond the regular dangers that come with big seasonal storms, a new threat has emerged: burping estuaries. Professor of Marine and Environmental Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill's Institute of Marine Sciences, Dr. Hans Perl, explains.
When these hurricanes perturb the system and mix everything up and redistribute the sediments from the bottom into the water column, they essentially cause this system to burp a huge amount of carbon dioxide back up in the air.
Why is this a problem? Well, it comes down to a surge of the greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide, suddenly being released into the environment. Scientists already knew that large bodies of water, like the Pamlico Sound, are great at absorbing CO2 like a sponge and storing it. But Dr. Perl, along with PhD student Joey Crosswell, who did most of the work for his dissertation, discovered that tropical storms and hurricanes cause carbon dioxide that has been building up for years to be released all at one time.
What the paper basically has concluded is that one major storm, in this case Hurricane Irene, which came along at the end of August in 2011, can cause the system to give up as much carbon dioxide as it actually accumulates over several years.
According to the study, Hurricane Irene-induced CO2 released from just the Neuse River estuary was at least four times the annual riverine carbon input and seven times the annual atmospheric CO2 uptake. Carbon dioxide is introduced into the Pamlico Sound and other bodies of water in a variety of ways. Tree and plant material can break off during storms, get washed away, and eventually end up in the estuary. The vegetative material is converted by microbes into CO2 by decomposition. Carbon can also be produced by plankton and microscopic organisms, as well as seagrasses and other aquatic plants. Dr. Perl says the largest contributor of carbon dioxide is from man-made sources.
Coastal environments act like a bank in the sense that they collect organic matter and anything that flows into them from the watershed, but also it collects material that's formed in the system itself. And if we think about carbon, the major sources of carbon that go into that sink are runoff from the watershed that delivers carbon that's grown on land and then ultimately washes into the systems.
When a tropical system passes over our area, it churns the water, causing the CO2 to be vented into the atmosphere. This release is what Dr. Perl refers to as a burp. While there's no evidence that the excess CO2 affects air quality, he says it does enhance the greenhouse effect.
There's sort of a feedback loop there. So these storms, which are increasing in intensity, and most of us think that's due to warming, which is caused by increasing carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, those storms come along and then cause more carbon dioxide to actually be lost.
Like estuaries, marshes are good at storing carbon dioxide. Dr. Perl says with an uptick in storms due to climate change, marshes will erode more and release more carbon into the air.
It's changing, the function of these systems. We know wetlands are really important in terms of storing up carbon, but if these perturbations come along and we get more of them over time, that will turn into more of a source, and so it will really actually kind of exacerbate the CO2 problem that we're experiencing. They will no longer be as good of a storage bank as they have been.
Burping estuaries are not a problem unique to eastern North Carolina. It happens in areas along the East Coast, the Gulf Coast, and even Asia, which is vulnerable to tropical typhoons. Since it's a global problem, burping estuaries could be a significant source of CO2 emissions into our atmosphere. The good news is that the efflux of CO2 from these systems can be controlled. Dr. Perl says the only way we can lessen the effect is to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide that's introduced into our environment.
And so that means controlling emissions, like agricultural emissions, for example, of agricultural waste, which generate quite a bit of CO2, but also power plants. We can reduce that by being able to trap CO2 before it leaves the smokestack, or to have more fuel-efficient and better conversion mechanisms in our vehicles, and to start using alternative fuels.
As we reduce the amount of carbon input into the water system, Dr. Pearl says vegetation in and around the estuaries that use CO2 will be able to keep up, eventually causing levels to stabilize.
I would think that we would see a reversal of this feedback loop, that, you know, the warming in the oceans will no longer occur at the rate that they currently do. There'll be cooling events, and I'm talking about long term now. I'm not talking about a single event. We're thinking decades to centuries in terms of the impacts of those kinds of management strategies.
The paper was published last week by the Association for the Sciences of Limnology and Oceanography. You can view the 15-page document and see pictures of research conducted in the Pamlico Sound at publicradioeast.org. This Saturday, the North Carolina Bluegrass Association is having their In the Pines Bluegrass Festival with music by a variety of artists, including Carolina Strings, Samantha Casey and the Bluegrass Jam, The Grass Strings, and New Blue.
The sky could open up and crack. The sun could burn the ocean dry.
Public Radio East's Mac McKee speaks with the secretary of the North Carolina Bluegrass Association, Jennifer Vinciguerra, about the festival at Goldsboro's Waynesboro Park.
How do you feel about this inaugural celebration?
I am very excited about it. We've put a lot of time and effort into planning this event, and we know it's going to be a fun day.
Now, what bluegrass instrument do you play, Jennifer?
I play the fiddle, and I've been playing the fiddle since I was about 8 years old. I started with violin lessons, but when I was 12, I discovered bluegrass, and it really piqued my interest.
Now, I know this is just the first year of the In the Pines Bluegrass Festival, but given the popularity of bluegrass all across North Carolina, I expect this thing to take off and be very popular in years to come. How about you?
Oh, I really hope so, especially with the IBMA, that's the International Bluegrass Music Association. That's the huge organization for bluegrass around the world. They have located into Raleigh for their big annual event, and I think that's really bringing more awareness about bluegrass music to people in North Carolina, and it's bringing it more to the surface. There's a lot of bluegrass that happens, but unless you're already in the circles, you don't really get to hear a lot about it, and we're hoping to help bring a more widespread appeal to another audience.
The North Carolina Bluegrass Association is only a couple of years old, so would that be the main headquarters in Goldsboro?
Yep, that's correct.
Now, are you hoping to have regional chapters pop up all across Eastern North Carolina in years to come?
We would love for that to happen. Right now, pretty much most of our work is focused in this eastern region of the state. We do have a few contacts in the western part of the state that are interested in being involved, so we'd love to have other chapters pop up, but at this point we don't have any, but we're looking to grow.
Jennifer, can you tell us about who's going to be appearing at this year's festival?
Oh, well, we have a great lineup. I'm really excited about New Blue. They're an up-and-coming young bluegrass band from North Carolina, and they recently recorded a single with R&B legend Sam Moore, so that's very exciting. And I think they're also going to be on Huckabee, if they haven't already been on his television show. We've also got Wayne Taylor in Appaloosa. Wayne Taylor was in the Navy's bluegrass band, and so that's pretty exciting. I didn't even know the Navy had a country and bluegrass band, but he was in it. Samantha Casey in the Bluegrass Jam will be performing. She's a very talented young fiddler. She's starting college this year at NC State. And Al Batten and the Bluegrass Reunion, they're a very popular local band. The band that I perform with, Carolina Tradition, will be there. And we've also got a band from the western part of the state called the Grass Strings.
Are most of these band for the first year of the In the Pines Bluegrass Festival, are they mostly from North Carolina, or have a lot of them gotten word out from all across the country and want to perform?
Well, right now, actually, all of these bands are from North Carolina, but just New Blue and Wayne Taylor are the more popular touring bands.
How about ticket prices for the In the Pines Bluegrass Festival? What are they?
At the gate, they will be $25. They can be purchased at the Foggy River Run on Ash Street in Goldsboro. Waynesboro Park, where the event will be held, and they can also be purchased at the Arts Council of Wayne County. Children 12 and under are admitted free, so they don't even need a ticket.
Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us here on the Down East Journal, and best of luck in the very first year of the In the Pines Bluegrass Festival.
Thank you very much. We have a great lineup of wonderful bands, so I hope people will come out to listen.
In Jacksonville, two former elementary school teachers have ambitious plans to open a children's museum. Co-chair of the Zing Zum Museum Board, Liz Owens, discusses with Public Radio East's Michael Peterson how the museum went from being just an idea to reality.
In 2005, Lonnie Brewerman and Liz Owens thought it would be a good idea to bring a children's museum to Jacksonville similar to the one in Wilmington. They were teaching kindergarten and first grade before they retired. During their tenure as teachers, they made frequent trips with their students to the Children's Museum of Wilmington. The downside of that, the hour-long drive to and from 8 into the school day. As Liz Owens began her research into creating a local children's museum, she took into account demographic information, which sealed her faith in the project.
Jacksonville is one of the youngest cities in the United States with an average of age of 25.7. There are 70,000 children in the region age 1 to 8 years.
A feasibility study was conducted, and as part of their research, Brewerman and Owens held a forum with community leaders and visited 20 children's museums in the United States. In 2007, the group received the 501c3 status as a nonprofit. A year later, the board of directors was established, which includes a diverse cross-section of community members.
We have a large group of retired teachers, and we have a doctor, we have a retired general, we have some business people in the community on our board, and we just have some young mothers.
In 2009, a countywide contest was carried out as Onslow students were tasked to come up with a name for the new children's museum. The winning name was Zing Zum, submitted by a kindergarten student from Swansboro Elementary.
Amazing. The Zing comes from amazing. And then she took the Z and put in front of museum. So it's Zing Zum, the end of museum.
Plans are for the Zing Zum Children's Museum to open early next year at the old Fire Station 2 in North Woods. Owen says the museum will feature 7 exhibits, each representing a different part of the imagination.
We will have a construction area where the children can build with Legos or different kinds of blocks, but all, of course, very safe. An animal care center, we have a vet in town that, and he says he wants to have an animal care center in there. Discovery Center would be geared more to science, so that the children can do simple little experiments with science.
There will also be a performing arts space and rooms dedicated to heroes, toddlers, and visual arts. Water activities will also be part of the new Children's Museum in Jacksonville.
We will have a grocery store because a lot of children are taken to the grocery store by their moms or dads. Now the children will take their moms and dads to the grocery stores. We will have a restaurant, again, letting the children be the ones to go in there and serve their parents.
Owen says they have raised over $100,000 for the museum, but still need $400,000 more, and they are raising the funds in a variety of ways.
We are selling tiles. We sell tiles on our website that will be permanently displayed in the museum. And these tiles you can put on there in memory of or in honor of or in thanksgiving for your children, your grandchildren.
The organization has done a Zing Zom Run, a family fun run, for the past 2 years to raise money. And this fall, the Zing Zom Children's Museum will start their capital campaign. Besides raising money for the museum, they also want to make people aware of the fact they are opening a children's museum by participating in community events such as Oktoberfest, the Kids Exchange Event, and Festival of Trees.
We've gone to things out on base, and some things we can sell or have games and activities for children to do. Other places, it's just for an awareness.
If funding pans out, Owen says the Zing Zom Children's Museum should be up and running by mid-2015. For more information about the new Children's Museum plan for Jacksonville, visit their website, zingzumm.com. I'm Michael Peterson.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Crystal Coast Dermatology Services, the office of Dr. Earl Gross, providing a full range of medical and surgical dermatology, and now welcoming Ms. Nicole Frost, nurse practitioner, to his staff. Crystal Coast Dermatology Services, Morehead City, 252-808-3376.
Hi, this is Tom the Jazz Man, inviting you to join me this and every Sunday evening right here from Public Radio East from 6 until 11 p.m. for the finest in recorded jazz, like Wes Montgomery. That's Sunday evening, 6 until 11 p.m. with Tom the Jazz Man on Public Radio East.
Followed at 11 p.m. by Judy Carmichael's Jazz Inspired on PRE, Public Radio East, News and Ideas.
Somehow I've made it into my mid-30s never owning a car. I'm Ari Shapiro, international correspondent for NPR. The problem is, with my job, I travel so much in Europe that the minute I master which direction to look for oncoming traffic in London, inevitably, I go to a story in some European country where they drive on the other side of the street, almost get killed, then come back to London and almost get killed again. Whether you love to drive or not, you can turn your car into the programs you love.
For more information, visit publicradioeast.org.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's and my farewell entry in the Garden Journal. I am both moving out of the Public Radio East zone and giving up my position as Horticulture Extension Agent. So I have to give up my Garden Journal spot. It's been wonderful. And I've decided for my last Garden Journal to talk to y'all just about my thoughts and feelings and theories about gardens and gardening. I guess it will really be my personal advice. So, first, grow some food. I don't care if it is just one fruit tree, but it's even better if it's seasonal food. Grow something that you harvest in the spring, something for the summer, and something for the fall. It not only helps you keep in touch with where food comes from, it gives you a feeling of accomplishment, and it links you to nature in a way that nothing other than growing your own food can do. And appreciate farmers. The job they do is very hard, and there are so many things that they can't control. And yet, they and their families struggle year after year to produce practically everything that you eat. Recognize that their children and grandchildren are there on that land, and they're doing everything they can to farm in a way that is as safe and healthy as possible. When you form your opinion about farmers and food and our food system, rely on true science, not pseudoscience and fear-mongering. Be aware and be concerned about the health of your food and your environment, but make sure you always understand and base your opinions on the facts. Next, surround yourself with trees. Plant trees now. They grow more quickly than you think. There is nothing more beautiful or soothing than the shade of a big tree in the hot summer, or the branches of a tree in the winter against a gray sky. Make sure a few of those trees are fruit trees and nut trees. Chocolate chip cookies are 10 times better when the nuts in them were grown in your own backyard. Okay, now plant things where they belong.
Put plants that like wet feet in wet areas, and plants that like dry ground in high, dry areas. Don't do it backwards. If a plant likes shade, put it there. Don't try and plant a plant that loves the sun in a shady spot. And don't try to plant a plant that only does well in Maine here in coastal North Carolina. Now, why do I say this? Because gardening in every aspect is supposed to be enjoyable and something that feeds your soul. If you're trying to push a large stone uphill all the time with regards to your gardening, it will become a chore rather than a pleasure. Design and plant every aspect of your garden so that every thought of it brings you joy. With the exception of one huge live oak that I adore, my new yard is a blank slate. I'll be trying to follow my own advice there over the next few years. I've enjoyed doing the Garden Journal more than you can imagine. Thank you all for your kind words when something that I've said in one of these segments has applied to you or have given you a new idea. Enjoy the rest of this summer and this fall out in your garden. Until next time, with a new host of the Garden Journal.
We're excited for Ann Edwards as she begins a new season of life. Today, we'd like to introduce you to our new Garden Journal host. Lisa Rayburn is the Horticulture Extension Agent with Onslow County. I caught up with her this week in Jacksonville.
I'd like to wish Ann good luck and happy journeys, because we'll miss Ann here in Onslow County as well. One of the great things that we have an opportunity to do in cooperative extension is agents across the state really help support each other and problem solve with each other. So Ann will be greatly missed.
Lisa, you are our new Garden Journal host. Congratulations.
Thanks, Jared.
Now, when did you first develop a love and interest in gardening?
So I got into gardening because of my parents. I was raised on a farm. We raised pick-your-own strawberries, beef cattle, and had a vegetable garden that stretched to the end of eternity. And after many years of forced involvement in the vegetable garden, I swore that I would never, ever garden again. And then I went to college and studied horticulture. And I've been in it ever since.
Are you from this area, from Eastern North Carolina?
I was born in upstate New York, and then went to high school and college in West Virginia. After college, I moved to the mountains of Western North Carolina. And then I made the move down here to take this job. So I've been here in Onslow County for 3.5 years.
So you've been kind of gradually moving south, closer and closer to warmer weather. What made you land here in eastern North Carolina? What made you decide to come to the eastern part of the state?
Right. So one of my lures for moving down here to the coast was that beautiful long growing season and the opportunity to grow plants that wouldn't survive outdoors in the mountains.
Lisa, you said before that you grew up on a farm. You've kind of been around gardening all your life, so it kind of runs in your blood. Do you have a big garden in your own backyard?
I have a very substantial container garden, so I probably have about 75 containers, flowers, vegetables, herbs, and a couple little tree fruits tucked in there as well.
Part of your job as the Horticulture Extension Agent is to field questions from residents there in Onslow County. So what types of questions are people asking about their home gardens?
So questions are very seasonal. And I can almost tell you what month of the year it is by the questions that we're getting in. In early spring, we get a lot of how-to. So how do I grow blueberries? How do I grow whatever the crop of the week is? As we move into the spring season, lots of questions about flowers and vegetables and getting those gardens started. Midsummer, it's a lot of what's wrong with my tomato plant? We go through a lot of what's wrong with my tomato plant. What's this insect? How do I control it? How do I control this problem? Lots of questions about lawns. You know, what's my lawn doing? Why is it not doing? Why is there a dead spot in my lawn? So it really runs the whole gamut. And then as we get towards the end of the season, it becomes how do I prepare for next year and how do I prevent problems that I saw this year next year.
And speaking of questions, Lisa, you're going to be answering some of our listeners' questions about gardens. Starting next week, you'll be able to submit your ideas for Garden Journal segments at our website, publicradioeast.org. Again, we'll start submissions for Garden Journal ideas next week. Lisa Rayburn is the Horticulture Extension Agent for Onslow County. Lisa, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Jared. It's great to be here.
Thanks for listening to the Downeast Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, you can drop us a line at publicradioeast.org. Have a great weekend.